Well, we get the hour underway by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
What's up, sir?
Busy checking my lists twice to make sure that they're up and ready to go for an interesting conversation, to say the least. You've got my mind going here. And Carrie and I were talking about this earlier. We're both list makers, but I also go into that second phase of list making, which involves the ranking of a number of different items from my life.
You what? Like your memories? Your family members? What does that mean?
Well, I have favorite family members. There's no question about that. Yeah, all of them. Everything. I've got a top 10 for everything going somewhere. I just don't know.
You have like a top 10 of, like, I know you like the Twilight Zone. You have a top 10 of that. So I like everything. You hit it all.
Yeah, I do. Now, I don't know if I could tell you what they are right off the top of my head, but I could easily come up with five of them without even batting an eye. Yeah.
That's funny. I like lists because I don't just like them. They're integral to what I do as an ordering process. So I've always assembled them in my head, like in church as a kid. And I was ranking Beatles albums or whatever it might have been. A lot of different things. Favorite episodes of some Cheers or whatever it could have been. But for me, like, if you read a short story of mine, if you saw what that came from, I would show you, like, a piece of paper often. Sometimes I just make it up out of the air. But I'd show you a piece of paper that would have, like, 6, 7, 10 words on it. And it'd be kind of, like, listed out, and there'd be one off to the side. It would mean absolutely nothing to you. And when I see that, because that's how I write the story is in those 6, 7, 10 words, whatever it might be, because they represent all of these other sentences and paragraphs and shapes and directions to me. And that's how a lot of how I create what I create. So I have this interest in lists, and I list out all of the many tasks I have to do, and I rank, really, like you, the things that I like best, and people I have to go after on the blog, and who's up next. I have lists for everything.
Did that start when you were a kid?
The internal component of it did as a kid. And I found that as I was making those lists as a kid, I could hold any amount of items in my head. And I didn't realize it at the time, that I just had this memory that could absorb anything. If something interests me, that's how I can write a story that's 5,000 words long when I'm out walking around and know where every comma is, because if something interests me, it lodges in my head. If I could go out on a date with someone that has absolutely nothing to say, and I can't distinguish them from anyone else, and literally 2 days later that night, as I enjoy a cucumber after coming home for supper, I might not remember their name. My mind just has this ordering principle that I've always had faith in. I've just always known it's going to work. I don't have to do anything. Just like I know I can sit there and a story will come to me. I just have that faith in my mind because of the way it's performed so many times over so many years. And list making was always a part of that, going back to ranking my favorite three investigators books when I was 7, 8, whatever the age I was.
Well, let's talk about some of these lists, some of these favorites. This is the one that fascinates me the most that we've discussed, and that's favorite smells.
Yeah, that was interesting to me because for many people, smell is the most evocative scent. It triggers memory, and smell's never really been that way for me. It probably won't surprise you to know that I am a word person. I'm a visual person, so the balance between sound and sense, I can remember exactly how somebody said something to me. Not just the words when I was 6 years old, their inflection. I think that comes out in what I create in my work. So smell's not even a really big one for me, but at the same time, I don't think it's a lesser one for me than it is for other people. And I always knew, like, right at the top, I have the ocean, but not just the ocean. I'm not interested in the Pacific, and I don't want that tropical Bermuda rubbish. I like Cape Ann. I like rugged Cape Cod. Even when I walk down to the harbor, and I do this without even knowing I'm doing it, because it's just that natural to me. If I go down and it's like raining out, I have, like, the Dunkin' Donuts coffee, I actually stand out over the harbor. I can't help but do it and let out a long and hearty, arr. I mean, I actually do. It's just going to, then, like, some woman walking her dog will look at me like, who is this, like the Gordon's fisherman here? What's going on? But I think with smell, it's interesting, as I formally wrote out my list, it says, and yours did too, I think, it says so much about who you are as a person and your interests more so than it does in the actual olfactory qualities of these things themselves, don't you think?
I do, and you know, you mentioned ocean. Ocean's on my list, but when I get more specific about it, it's one combination of scents, and for me and Carrie, you'll know where I'm talking about. It's at that time of year when the lobster shacks have opened down on the island, and just as you cross the Trenton Bridge to go on to Mount Desert Island, that combination of the ocean, preferably at low tide, and the wood smoke from the lobster shacks, that combination might be my favorite scent on Earth.
Yeah, but I have a specific, sort of specific notion as well with everything. Like when you go over the bridge to Cape Ann and go into Gloucester, it's called going over the cut, and it's like the air changes there, and the air changes there from also August to late September. So I have something on my list, like kind of further down, like freshly dug earth. But freshly dug earth in autumn is different than freshly dug earth in April. And I find what's interesting too is the emotion, the, like, for instance, chlorine, a pool. I'm not, that doesn't make my list. But I remember when I was a kid, like swimming lessons. I wasn't a great swimmer, so I got sunk to the bottom. But there was an apprehension, and I wanted to perform well. I didn't want to sink, and I wanted to swim. I'm a man of the sea. I'm doing the R. I should be able to survive if I'm knocked overboard from my poop deck or whatever it may have been. And you're with your peers. You have these swimming lessons. So when I smell that, it still triggers in me this need to not embarrass myself within the pool, not sink to the bottom of the same thing with the rink. I go into a rink, I like you. But if I go into a rink and you're next to me, I want to lower my shoulder and end you, Kimball. I want to drop you so hard on the ground, and like you're writhing around. It's like, oh, slow my tongue. I'm like, get up, loser. You can talk. It's fine. So all of these things are suggestive of these other things. But most of mine are tethered to the sea, to autumn, the burnt air of autumn.
Oh, yes.
Hot road tar reminds me of the sea. Iodine smells like seaweed. Stewed tea has that, again, that New England kind of density to it. Strong black coffee, burnt fish, smoked fish, wood fires that you mentioned. How about a brush fire in the backyard? And I realize that all of my things are related to interests I have and a region I love that is just so imagistic to me, including with smell.
And there's one that I had forgotten about, and I just thought about it today, and I still do this. Every time I put on my now almost 30-year-old baseball glove, the first thing I do is put my nose right in that glove and smell that leather.
I have a baseball one for you that I came up with after our conversation, too, and you could combine these two smells for a nice summer afternoon. A freshly opened vintage pack of Topps baseball cards.
Oh, wow, yes.
Because you not only have the bubble gum, and you have the cardboard, and they react together in this sort of like weird alchemy. You have that waxy rubber that becomes part of the whole amalgamation process, too. And then you have, and there's like this phantom smell of expectation. Like, do I have somebody, do I have, oh, it's my 17th Dave Kingman card of the year. I don't need this. Like, where's the Wade Boggs? Oh, look, it's Fisk. I don't have this one yet. And so that was just, again, such a heady, not just a time of youth, but I think if I smelt that now, it's like Strawberry Fields Forever. Like, you're going back to that place, and that place has roots in the past, but the leaves have come off the tree, and they've blown through the present and even into your future.
Yeah, and that's why Bruce mentioned among his favorite smells is the forest floor, but particularly in November. And that has powerful memories for me, but also just because I like the change of seasons. My favorite seasons are spring and fall, because to me that's when you have the greatest amount of change. And I know some people don't like that about November because they know what's coming, but I always enjoy that.
The forest floor in November is like this recipe, like it's finally ready to take the top off the pot and for you to inhale what that recipe is. Because there's that peat quality, that very decayed vegetation quality, and it has to be made. The leaves have to fall, the animals have to die, everything has to come together in this carpentry of nature, and you walk through a place like Concord now, and you do it in November, and Novembers are here, certainly, they seem to get milder by the year with everything that's happening with the atmosphere, and you can read through in your mind what you've encountered in Thoreau's journals, and he's talking about the same things that he smelled too, and it's so unchanged, and it wouldn't have been there a month before, and then it's going to turn into December, and again, it's just that cycling through, and that smell becomes something that is almost like an extension of who you are.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Let's move to another list, favorite animals.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this because, again, it's like, I don't really like people as much if they're like, I like giraffes and lions. No, don't give me that Sahara. God, not, no. Keep it, New England's just better. Localize things in New England. And if you're listening, beautiful, talented woman out there that eventually I'm going to end up with after you write me because you read something so powerful, you contact me via my site. Just have your ducks in order. I like ducks.
Oh,
allergies
ducks.
For ducks. Have them in order when you get in touch and just know, like, the right animals to say. Like, I was a kid, and I'm, like, 10 years old, and I'm out in the woods. And there's this snapping turtle on the banks of this brook. And this wasn't, like, egg-laying season or anything like this. This snapping turtle is advancing upon me. I'm like, what are you up to? And he's giving me this eye, like, I will do you. We'll make it happen right here. I can set that up for you. Like, he wasn't very quick. He was up on land. So I'm thinking, you, sir, have pluck. He's like, yeah, I know. I'll mess you up. And then another time, I'm at the same brook, and there's this baby snapping turtle. And, like, I pick it up, and I put it in the land. It can't do anything. This dude turns around. He's like, oh, yeah? I'll do you, too. I'm like, wow, you are my favorite animal. You're great. Like, river otters, even though they're just, like, habitual rapists, people think river otters are so cute. Dolphins as well. They do, like, really bad things. Or rapey sport. Look that up on Google. I like raccoons. I like beavers. I'm writing a children's book about a beaver, and it's like they're the only animal that it sounds biblical, who impose their will. It sounds like some sort of like Old Testament thing, doesn't it? On their environment besides man. Do you know how the number one way, kind of ironic, that most beavers are killed?
I do not know.
They are crushed under their own handiwork as the tree comes down in the night.
Oh, man.
it's like this Dantean contrapasso. But live by the sword, die by the sword, yeah. Kimball.
I like skunks myself. And part of it is that they look so, if you didn't know, they look so sweet and cuddly. I love the way they walk. They move with, some indifference to the world around them because they know that of all the strange defense mechanisms that nature has handed out, theirs is relatively unique, and I like that about them.
They get a bad rep because skunks are wonderfully resourceful creatures. They'll find a way. They'll forage. They're kind of like the rodent version of the cockroach. And their smell, as we move back to that, it is so overrated in terms of its putridity. Like, it's annoying to get it off of your clothes or your dog or whatever it may be, but it's not like this vomit-inducing smell. It's not the sewer truck is outside. It's not that off-putting, actually. And I just remember, like, that smell as a kid. It was like a lemon. I like lemons. I can suck a lemon. I can bite into a lemon, not because I'm like some bitter hag, but because I can just do that. But I remember, like, when I was a kid, we'd have fish. I'm like, oh, this lemon's not pretty. It was pretty good. Actually really good for your liver, too, you heavy drinkers. And I would just, my parents would be looking at me like, what is wrong with you? That's so foul. And it's like, no, it really isn't. Same deal with when you're driving home at night, and you must encounter this all the time where you live.
Oh, yeah.
At night, and of course, there's that skunk smell. You got a raccoon or a deer or a dog or whatever it happened to be. And I just think they get this unfair reputation.
Well, I find, too, that, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but there's a difference between the casual spraying done in self-defense and what you get after, as we get around here, a skunk has been flattened by a truck. That seems to be a much more powerful and pungent aroma than just, hey, get out of my face. Psst, there you go.
Plus it travels.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Caked into those wheels, and it has some sticking power to it. But I don't know. I've never been bothered by. I like skunks, and sometimes too, they'll see you, and they are particular about when they're going to let you have it. I've seen instances where you can get away with quite a bit, or a dog can get away with quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Skunks like, I'm just not feeling it tonight, dude. Come back tomorrow. I'll give you a faceful.
I had, funny you mention that. I had a basset hound several years ago who on at least three different occasions in the early morning would be walking within a few feet behind a skunk, but I think the skunk looked back and said, oh, no, it's a little hush puppy dog. I'm not going to do it. It's not worth it. He means me no harm. Continue on your way, fellow furry friend.
They're not dumb animals, skunks. And you mentioned pigs, and that was one that I had initially left out.
Oh, yeah.
A pig is such a bright creature. Pigs are smarter than, this will sound strange, but for the most part, I'm not a huge dog person, and I know I will catch flack for this, even though I haven't featured in works, but I detest cats. I think they're just foul, self-licking, hairball-hawking, arrogant, narcissist creatures.
Carrie has the biggest smile on his face that I've ever seen right now.
I mean, it's like, yeah, you know what I'm saying, Kimball. That's why those bags are out there, and that's how that used to be taken care of. Now, I'm not advocating, listeners, that you go out and do some, like, local cat genociding tonight. But if you did, you write me on my side, I won't tattle. We're good. Nasty creatures.
All right, we move from animals to, but this was the toughest one of all three, I think, for me, favorite Beatles albums.
You struggled with this one. Let me think if I know what a guy like you would go with. I'm going to guess, let's see, Rubber Soul?
Rubber Soul, number one.
Okay, I have Rubber Soul as my, I have it as their second best album, and probably my second or third, or maybe fourth favorite Beatles album. My favorite is, if we're talking official, is the White Album. And I have a kind of out of the norm choice for my actual favorite because I think it's the most emblematic of the Beatles. And
you're going to go one of the BBC albums, I bet.
Yeah, I'm going to do the full package because I think that's where you get everything rammed together in one. You get the personality, the camaraderie, the spontaneity, the ingenuity. You get their songs. You get multiple versions of their songs. You get the Beatles in there. Clubhouse and interacting with each other and making jokes with each other that people who aren't a member of that group won't even really understand. It's like a hockey locker room with Bach level musicianship, or what was eventually going to be Bach level musicianship. And one album that's always been there for me, I have a very different ranking of their best albums and their my favorite albums.
Like, oh, me too.
It would not be in their top five for best albums for me. But I think A Hard Day's Night is right up there as a favorite for me. I think it's their one perfect album. And people can say, wait, this is the perfect album. Shouldn't it be better than all the other ones? But perfection doesn't really work that way because sometimes it's a matter of how much we're willing, not just in life, but as artists to risk. And I think there are other Beatles albums that take greater chances than A Hard Day's Night. But as a statement of pop and music perfection, it's just one of the standbys for that. And I'm surprised too because it's overshadowed by the so-called hits, the A side of that long player. But the B side is a prefiguration of in my life of Strawberry Fields Forever. It's deeply introspective and it's encompassing themes that people were not writing about at the time outside of, say, Dylan, but it's much more melodic than what Dylan was doing contemporarily.
Now, I also have an asterisk pair of albums on my list because they were collections, but they're big to me because I'm old enough that I remember watching the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, but I wasn't a huge Beatles fan as a little kid, and it wasn't until I was about 11 or 12, kind of coordinating with when they broke up, that I really began to embrace the band. And so for me, pretty high on the list are the Blue and the Red Greatest Hits albums that came out, I think, in 72 or 73, which, you know, at an age when you really start to embrace music as one of the most important things in your life, reminded me of how great they were and reintroduced me to the band.
As soon as you started talking there, I was going to guess the Red and the Blue albums, and it's interesting that you're talking about 73 and hearing them. When I was a mid-teen and we were on Cape Cod, and I'm probably like thinking all these things that are going to end up in a different form and buried on the beaches, but that's really where I discovered the Beatles, and sitting in the back seat with the Walkman and the parents. Just, you think they're so old, they're up in the front and they're like in their 30s doing whatever. And I was listening to the Red and the Blue albums a lot. The ones I had, my core at the time, was those two albums, the 20 Greatest Hits, the Live at the Hollywood Bowl album, and it's interesting, too, because you never hear any talk of this record, the Rock and Roll Collection. And it was just a compilation of, like, Slow Down. And one of the things that I'm writing about in this book of, on the Beatles that I'm doing, Same Band You've Never Known, is that the allure that these compilations have, because they shouldn't really have the allure in the pull that they do, because they're not officially sanctioned. They're not artistic statements. But they have this transcendent quality anyway, because you have this mishmash on rock and roll of, like, Larry Williams numbers, and here's the Chuck Berry rock and roll music song. And they're just like, okay, here you go, here's Bad Boy, and let's stick these together. And yet it somehow still works as this special album on its own. And the Red and the Blue were that way, too. They were amplifications of what you got with the 20 Greatest Hits. And I listened to the Red one more than the Blue, but when they came out on CD, I had to get those, because they were statements themselves. They just were out of the official kind of timeline and chronology.
Yeah, I love it. Great stuff. Fun with lists. We have to do this again sometime with more topics. This was great. Next week we're going to talk about the incredible run of creativity that you've been on here over the course of the last couple of years that is phenomenal, not in terms, well, quantity, yes, but quality even more so. So I'm looking forward to that. Colin, thank you as always, my friend.
All right. Thank you, sir.